6. Lost Souls. Preaching climate apocalypse is different from fearing of death. Where most of us don't want to think about our deaths, some people seem excited when they talk about the end of the world, whether from the Mayan apocalypse, Y2K, or climate change. That deep sense that the world might come to an end is a strange mix of fear and desire, Dick said. Everyone would like to see their enemies destroyed in horrible ways, wouldn't they? He chuckled. Dick admitted he fantasized about seeing the atomic destruction of his hometown, where he had been starved and abused as a boy, something he wrote about in his affecting 1990 memoir, A Hole in the World. Remember when the TV movie, The Day After, about nuclear apocalypse, was shown in 1983? It was located in and around Kansas City, Missouri, my hometown. I lived there at the time. I remember watching it when it was first shown, he said. When those missiles came over the horizon and were targeted at Kansas City, I remember having mixed feelings. Oh, wow, they're going to destroy Kansas City. But also, oh my God, how horrible. Dick laughed at this. You know, both. Few apocalyptic environmentalists have as understandable a reason to fantasize of their hometowns being annihilated as Dick Rhodes. But could a similar hatred of human civilization, and perhaps humanity itself, be behind claims of environmental apocalypse? There's a strain of the environmental movement that is Calvinistic, Dick said, in the sense that the world is an evil place and it would be better if it were destroyed and turned back over to the natural kingdom. If the climate apocalypse is a kind of subconscious fantasy for people who dislike civilization, it might help explain why the people who are the most alarmist about environmental problems are also the most opposed to the technologies capable of addressing them, from fertilizer and flood control to natural gas and nuclear power. After 2 weeks of Extinction Rebellion parading coffins through the street, blocking traffic, and stopping tube trains, many Britons had had enough. "Let us no longer beat around the bush about these people," wrote one British columnist. "This is an upper-middle-class death cult." "I want you to panic," said Thunberg to a gathering of world leaders in Davos, Switzerland, in January 2019. "If standing up against the climate, an ecological breakdown, and for humanity, is against the rules, then the rules must be broken," she tweeted in October. 2 days later, two male Extinction Rebellion protesters stood on top of a train to block it from moving forward in the London Tube. Angry commuters kicked and beat one of the young protesters and another young man filming the event. "I was frightened by the scene and watched it several times. My thought each time was that the commuters could quite easily have killed the two men. Many in the crowd were gripped by a sudden, uncontrollable fear and wildly unthinking behavior. In other words, they were in a panic. When I complained to Lunan by phone about the tube incident, her response was that, thanks to Extinction Rebellion, climate change had been in the news extensively in the run-up to the British elections. She offered the same justification for the tube protest on British television. A co-host on This Morning asked Lunan if her group's decision to cancel further protests was sort of an admission that you got it wrong this time. "I don't think we've got it wrong necessarily," said Lunan, "because today I'm sitting in this studio, and we've been bumped 3 times from This Morning's studios in the last 10 days, and it's taken us being this disruptive to get on your program." "Is that why you did it?" asked one of the hosts. "That man glued himself onto an electric train," asks the other host, angrier now. "So you could get on This Morning?" "Not so we can get on This Morning, obviously," said Lunan, backtracking. "But unless we do very, very disruptive actions, people do not want to talk to us." On BBC's Newsnight, as host Emma Barnett was wrapping up the program, Lunan practically shouts, "No, we waited. We waited for 30 years for capitalism to work, and it hasn't worked." "And Emma," says Lunan, "when you go home, you will look at your children and think, I've got a 50-50 chance of it staying in their world that we know as it is today. Lenin pivoted to another camera and says, "And the people looking at home, you as well." Thunberg displayed a similar anger in her speech to the United Nations in September 2019. "This is all wrong," she says. "I shouldn't be standing here. I should be back in school, on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope?" she said, practically shouting. "How dare you?" The late British philosopher Roger Scruton thought deeply about the politics of anger. On the one hand, he believed it was valuable and necessary. "Resentment is to the body politic what pain is to the body," he wrote. "Bad to feel it, but good to be capable of feeling it, since without the ability to feel it, we will not survive." The problem, Scruton argued, is when resentment loses the specificity of its target and becomes directed to society as a whole, Scruton concludes. At that point, resentment becomes an existential posture, adopted not to negotiate within existing structures, but to gain total power, so as to abolish the structures themselves. That posture is, in my view, the core of a serious social disorder. Another word for what Scruton is describing is nihilism. Young people learning about climate change for the first time might understandably believe, upon listening to Lenin and Thunberg, that climate change is the result of deliberate, malevolent actions. In reality, it is the opposite. Emissions are a byproduct of energy consumption, which has been necessary for people to lift themselves, their families, and their societies out of poverty and achieve human dignity. Given that's what climate activists have been taught to believe, it's understandable that so many of them would be so angry. But such anger can worsen loneliness. When you educate yourself about the climate, you do tend to separate yourself from your friends and family, Lenin said on Sky News. "It's very hard to separate yourself from your friends and your family, who may well be catching flights and eating roast dinners every Sunday." The problem is that people tend to feel put down by climate activists who condemn economic growth, eating meat, flying, and driving. "Why would people listen to you?" asked Lenin, "when, you know, you're some kind of New Age Puritan." As such, while some climate leaders and activists may derive psychological benefits from climate alarmism, the evidence suggests that many more people are harmed by it, including the alarmists themselves. Lauren Jeffrey, the 17-year-old in Britain, noticed heightened anxiety among her peers after Extinction Rebellion's protests. "In October, I was hearing people my age saying things I found quite disturbing," says Jeffrey. "It's too late to do anything. There is no future anymore. We're basically doomed. We should give up." Thunberg and her mother say that watching videos about plastic waste, polar bears, and climate change contributed to her depression and eating disorder. "So when I was 11, I became ill. I fell into depression. I stopped talking and I stopped eating. In 2 months, I lost about 10 kilos of weight. Later on, I was diagnosed with Asperger syndrome, OCD, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and selective mutism. 20 years ago, I discovered that the more apocalyptic environmentalist books and articles I read, the sadder and more anxious I felt. This was in sharp contrast to how I felt after reading histories of the civil rights movement, whose leaders were committed to an ethos and politics of love, not anger. It was, in part, my awareness of the impact that reading about climate and the environment had on my mood that led me to doubt whether environmentalism could be successful. It was only several years later that I started to question environmentalism's claims about energy, technology, and the natural environment. Now that I have, I can see that much of my sadness over environmental problems was a projection and misplaced. There is more reason for optimism than pessimism. Conventional air pollution peaked 50 years ago in developed nations, and carbon emissions have peaked or will soon peak in most others. The amount of land we use for meat production is declining. Forests in rich nations are growing back, and wildlife are returning. There is no reason poor nations can't develop and adapt to climate change. Deaths from extreme events should keep declining. Cruelty to animals and meat production has declined and should continue to decline. And if we embrace technology, habitats available for endangered species, including for gorillas and penguins, should keep growing in size. None of that means there isn't work to do. There is plenty. But much, if not most of it, has to do with accelerating those existing positive trends, not trying to reverse them in a bid to return to low-energy agrarian societies. And so, while I can empathize with the sadness and loneliness behind the anger and fear-mongering about climate change, deforestation, and species extinction, I can see that much of it is wrong, based on unaddressed anxieties, disempowering ideologies, and misrepresentations of the evidence. 7. Environmental humanism. The answer from many rational environmentalists, including myself, who are alarmed by the religious fanaticism of apocalyptic environmentalism, has been that we need to better maintain the divide between science and religion, just as scientists need to maintain the divide between their personal values and the facts they study. Others, like Scruton, urge us to aim for a world where conflicts are resolved according to a shared conception of justice and the building and governance of institutions, and to the thousand ways in which people enrich their lives through corporations, traditions, and spheres of accountability. But Scruton himself doubted that such a rationalist project could succeed against the apocalyptic tendencies of the regressive left. Clearly, we are dealing with the religious need, a need planted in our species' being, he writes. There is a longing for membership that no amount of rational thought, no proof of the absolute loneliness or humanity or of the unredeemed nature of our sufferings can ever eradicate. Attempts to affirm the boundary between science and religion will thus likely not work so long as apocalyptic environmentalists speak to deep human needs for meaning and purpose and environmental rationalists don't. As such, we need to go beyond rationalism and re-embrace humanism, which affirms humankind's specialness, against Malthusian and apocalyptic environmentalists who condemn human civilization and humanity itself. As environmental humanists, whether scientists, journalists, or activists, we must ground ourselves first in our commitment to the transcendent moral purpose of universal human flourishing and environmental progress, and then in rationality. When Sir Francis Bacon urged that the quest for truth be balanced by morality, he quoted the Apostle Paul, "Knowledge bloweth up, but charity buildeth up." Bacon didn't call for hard limits on knowledge so much as a constant orientation of scientists around the emotion behind the best moralities. The corrective spice to science, said Bacon, was charity or love. As such, when we hear activists, journalists, IPCC scientists, and others claim climate change will be apocalyptic unless we make immediate radical changes, including massive reductions in energy consumption, we might consider whether they are motivated by love for humanity or something closer to its opposite. As I write these words, Bernadette remains a refugee in her own country. She and her husband remain at risk of being kidnapped or worse, and she must spend her days working someone else's land, which she understandably experiences as a profound loss of dignity. I have kept Bernadette in the foreground throughout Apocalypse Never to remind us, particularly those of us in developed nations, to feel gratitude for the civilization we take for granted, put claims of climate apocalypse in perspective, and inspire empathy and solidarity for those who do not yet enjoy the fruits of prosperity. The stories we tell matter. The picture promoted by apocalyptic environmentalists is inaccurate and dehumanizing. Humans are not unthinkingly destroying nature. Climate change, deforestation, plastic waste, and species extinction are not fundamentally consequences of greed and hubris, but rather side effects of economic development motivated by a humanistic desire to improve people's lives. A core ethic of environmental humanism is that rich nations must support, not deny, development to poor nations. Specifically, rich nations should lift the various restrictions on development aid for energy production in poor and developing nations. It is hypocritical and unethical to demand that poor nations follow a more expensive and thus slower path to prosperity than the West followed. As the last nations to develop, it is already going to be harder for them to industrialize. The good news is that in many nations, including African ones, cheap hydroelectricity and natural gas will likely be available. But if coal is the best option for poor and developing nations, then rich nations in the West must support that option. As the cradle of humankind's evolution, the Albertine Rift region is of great significance to people everywhere. The presence of the endangered mountain gorillas, our evolutionary cousins, magnifies its importance. Despite the success of gorilla protection, much of the conservation activities in the region have failed in the absence of military security and economic development. Cheap hydroelectricity from the Grand Inga Dam could power the southern African region, including the factories, which remain the only way we know how to transform large numbers of unskilled subsistence farmers into city people. The main opposition to the dam outside of the Congo comes from apocalyptic environmentalists. Environmental humanists should stand up to them. The West owes Congo a significant debt. The palm oil it provided the world helped save the whales, a magnificent achievement. But its people continue to suffer. Belgians colonized and created the nation, but then abandoned it in the early 1960s, leaving the country in disarray. Neither the United States nor the Soviet Union covered itself with glory there during the Cold War. Since the end of the Cold War, the United Nations and Western nations have failed to end the worsening violence in eastern Congo, which most experts believe stems from Rwanda's desire to maintain chaos as cover for continued mineral extraction. Many of the experts I interviewed believe Western governments are afraid to demand change from Rwanda out of some mix of guilt for having failed to stop the 1994 genocide and fear that the region will return to civil war. Until then, conservationists and environmental humanists have an interest in advocating for a resolution to the ongoing insecurity, which has traumatized generations of people with no end in sight. In early 2020, I chatted through Facebook using Google Translate with Suparti in Indonesia. "Yes, I still live in the same house," she said. In 2016, she married a man she met through Facebook who works for Sharp Semiconductor and quickly became pregnant. "My daughter was supposed to be born on January 18th, but there were complications. I eventually underwent a cesarean section on January 30th. The birth of her daughter sounded harrowing. I had to go to 4 hospitals, and most of them had no doctor at that time because it was the end of the year," she said. "Finally, I found a hospital with a doctor. We went into surgery right away." 100 years ago, Suparti could easily have suffered a far worse outcome. "Thanks to God," said Suparti. "She was born healthy and safe. I went back to work 40 days later." Suparti still works for the chocolate factory and has seen her salary rise and her responsibilities grow. She is now involved in the factory's computer systems, having risen through the ranks of packaging and labeling from pouring chocolate back in 2015. "I want 4 children, 2 boys and 2 girls," she said. "Thanks to God, my parents are all healthy, my siblings are all good, and I am happy. I am grateful to have a husband who is very kind and patient." Suparti sent me 2 photos through Facebook. One was of her husband and her, and the other was of her daughter wearing a bright pink hijab. A big smile stretched across her tiny face. News media, editors, and journalists might consider whether their constant sensationalizing of environmental problems is consistent with their professional commitment to fairness and accuracy, and their personal commitment to being a positive force in the world. While I am skeptical that stealth environmental activists working as journalists are likely to change how they do their reporting, I am hopeful that competition from outside traditional news media institutions, made possible by social media, will inject new competitiveness into environmental journalism and raise standards. Improving environmental journalism requires coming to grips with some fundamentals. Power density determines environmental impact. As such, coal is good when it replaces wood and bad when it replaces natural gas or nuclear. Natural gas is good when it replaces coal and bad when it replaces uranium. Only nuclear energy can power our high-energy human civilization while reducing humankind's environmental footprint. Power-dense farming, including of fish, creates the prospect of shrinking humankind's largest environmental impact. We need to correct our misunderstanding of nuclear energy. It was born from good intentions, not bad ones, nor from some mindless accident of science. Nuclear weapons were created to prevent war and end war, and that is all they have been used for and all they will ever be good for. The United States and other developed nations should renew the commitments they made under Atoms for Peace in the 1950s in the form of a green nuclear deal, for reasons including, but going beyond, climate change. That will require recognizing that nuclear weapons, like nuclear energy, are here to stay. We can't get rid of them, even if we wanted to, for reasons experts have understood since 1945. And trying to do so has contributed to decades of tension and conflict, culminating in the unnecessary and disastrous U.S. and British invasion of Iraq in 2003. The continued existence of nuclear weapons reminds us that they hold the potential to create, if not apocalypse, then at the very least, the destruction of cities and perhaps even civilizations. Such weapons should, if we are sentient human beings, stimulate some amount of anxiety. Call it existential angst. We need to find a better way to manage and channel those anxieties, confronting them directly as objects of death and even as symbols of the apocalypse may help. When Dick Rhodes and I talked about Extinction Rebellion's protests in London, it wasn't the first time we had talked about death. A few months earlier, over lunch, I told him I thought the continued existence of nuclear weapons should remind us to be happy to be alive. "You mean like a memento mori?" said Dick. "Yes," I said, after he reminded me that memento mori, which means remember you will die in Latin, is something people use to remind them of their mortality and thus feel gratitude toward life. The classic memento mori is the skull, like those seen in still-life paintings by European artists in the Middle Ages. They appear to have become more popular after the Black Death. What if we treated objects of mass destruction as memento mori? Experiments inspired by Ernest Becker's work suggest that doing so could help with our angst. When psychologists encourage people to think of their eventual deaths, they tend to feel anxious about how they are living their lives. But when they encourage people to imagine they are dying and to look back on their lives, they tend to do so with gratitude, appreciation, and greater love toward those around them. The same has been true for me after visiting poor and developing nations, whether as a researcher or tourist. I believe that if environmental scientists, journalists, and activists spent more time talking to people about their daily struggles in places like Indonesia and the Congo, they would be less likely to see the end of the world and reason to panic in every new environmental problem. 8. Love is greater than science. In early 2017, I leased retail space in Berkeley, California, for my new research organization, Environmental Progress, which I had created the year before. The previous tenant had sold fast fashion that was no longer fashionable. I loved the idea of being in street-level retail space in Berkeley, home to the inventors of nuclear energy, its opponents, and later, in the form of Will Seary, its advocates. We would be picking up where Seary left off, and I felt the desire to be more grounded, to actually advocate something, not just research and write about it. Most of the space was a single large room with high ceilings and windows. There was an open upstairs balcony, about 5 feet wide, that hovers over the room. Wood and tarnished copper bars ringed the balcony, from which protruded tacky wood beams. The floor was concrete. We knew the existence of an openly pro-nuclear environmental organization in downtown Berkeley might trigger people, so we sought to make the space calming and inviting. To open up the space, we cut off the beams and painted the whole room white, except for the windows and copper bars, which we polished. Helen painted, stained, and sealed the floor, resulting in a rich, marbled, and calming ocean of sky blue. It worked. Most of the people who come in off the street remain calm and even open-minded upon learning that we are pro-nuclear. Because the space is zoned retail, we are required to sell items, and so we started purchasing and reselling nuclear memorabilia from the 50s and 60s, including uranium glass jewelry and Atoms for Peace stamps. We turned the upstairs balcony into a gallery. I created the exhibit with photos I'd taken around the world that tell the story of environmental progress through people's lives. There is a photo of Bernadette, half angry and half proud, standing where the baboons ate her sweet potatoes. There is a photo of one of the mountain gorilla orphans with a Mona Lisa smile and a flower in her mouth. There is a photo of Caleb, smiling, and holding the hand of Daniel, the Spanish engineer, as we walk to the Virunga Dam. There is a photo of Suparti standing next to the sewing machine she doesn't use. And there is a photo, the only one that's not mine, of the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant. In my upstairs office, which overlooks the balcony and the main room, Helen hung a poster from the World's Fair in Chicago from 1933 to 1934. It was made during some of the darkest years of the Great Depression, and yet it expresses a far more optimistic view of the future than the one offered by most environmentalists today. The fair's theme was technological innovation, and the name of the exposition was A Century of Progress, which celebrated Chicago's 100th anniversary. The tagline was Science Finds, Industry Applies, Man Adapts, a perfect motto for mitigating and adapting to climate change. The fair celebrated technology and progress, a utopia, or perfect world, founded on democracy and manufacturing, a perfect motto for achieving prosperity for all. Nature and prosperity for all determine how we do our research, not the other way around. No amount of science can prove that you should support our mission, just as no amount of science can make you want to protect mountain gorillas. All we can do is show you photos and tell you stories about Bernadette and Suparti and hope they make you care, in the same way they have made us care. When my staff and I meet, these images of a high-energy, prosperous world with flourishing wildlife frame our thinking. They represent our commitment to goals that are human and natural, rational and moral, and physical and spiritual. Research should be, we believe, in service of some ultimate value. Ours are the love of humanity and the love of nature. By the time we were finished renovating the office, I realized we had created a shrine of sorts to a vision that could be fairly called spiritual. Nature and prosperity for all is our transcendent moral purpose. Environmental progress is our immortality project. In 2015, a few days after Bernadette showed me where baboons had eaten her sweet potatoes, Helen and I viewed the endangered mountain gorillas up close and in person. We stayed at Merode's Resort in Virunga Park. In the heart of a war zone, we ate delicious food and slept in the rainforest, surrounded by colobus monkeys and chimpanzees. It was Eden inside the apocalypse. To see the gorillas, Virunga Park rangers armed with machine guns took us by jeep and then by foot through the cattle pastures that were once habitat for the primates. We passed through communities of farmers who came out of their homes to wave and smile at us. We got out and hiked for a bit through cattle ranches that run next to the edge of the park boundary, a reminder of the pent-up demand for land and the pressure of a growing human population. We smelled the gorillas before we saw them. Their smell was unique, a pungent mix of very strong body odor, musky perfume, and skunk. We stared at them and they stared back. We gasped at our first sight of a silverback. He grunted disapprovingly at the clacking of my camera's shutter. He wanted to be left alone. Our guide motioned for us to give him space. The hour we had with the gorillas flew by. Helen and I resolved on the spot to see them again, which we did in Uganda 1 week later. As in Congo, reaching the gorillas required walking through village after village of poor farmers, pressed up against the park boundary and trying to cope with animals eating their crops. The first gorilla we saw had violated the invisible park border and was eating from a tree on a farmer's land. The second gorilla we saw was a magnificent silverback, one that was much more tolerant of our noisy cameras and our groups oohing and aahing than the one in Congo had been. Finally, we were treated to the sight of an infant gorilla. Its mother lay a few feet away. She smiled at us as her baby played near her. It felt like we were two individuals in a single primate community. Scientists warn against the anthropomorphization of animals, but it is impossible not to see gorillas as kin, particularly when they are smiling at you. People who see gorillas in the wild feel awe and wonder, a mix of happiness, surprise, and a bit of fear. "This wonderful and frightful production of nature walks upright like a man," wrote a sea captain after he and his men had stumbled upon gorillas on the African coast in 1774. It was a story the man likely recounted for years afterward, with emotion and excitement. Scientists have long named self-interest as a reason for why humans should care about endangered species like the mountain gorilla. But if the mountain gorillas were ever to go extinct, humankind would become spiritually, not materially, poorer. Happily, nobody saves mountain gorillas, yellow-eyed penguins, and sea turtles because they believe human civilization depends on it. We save them for a simpler reason. We love them. Epilogue. Few things make one feel more immortal than saving the life of a nuclear plant. Maybe that's because nuclear energy itself could be said to be immortal. 1,000 years from now, future humans might still be producing nuclear power from the same locations they do so today. Today's nuclear plants can easily operate for 80 years and might run for 100 if they are well maintained and parts are replaced when necessary. Like Cesare Marchetti's typewriters, each successive plant will be better until we arrive at fusion and start the process all over again. And so, between 2016 and 2020, I worked with environmental humanists around the world to save nuclear power plants. It's had an impact. Where nuclear energy was viewed just a few years ago as optional, it is today increasingly viewed as essential for dealing with climate change. In 2019, my colleagues and I organized pro-nuclear demonstrations in more than 30 cities around the world. We were inspired by Greta Thunberg's student strike for the climate, which started with just one or two people, like herself, in many places. We asked people to take the simplest of tasks, stand up for nuclear. In German town squares, outside train stations in South Korea, and on university campuses in the United States, pro-nuclear activists stood at tables, handing out information, showing videos, and debunking nuclear myths. Many offered balloons and face painting for children. In December 2019, 120 people from Germany, Poland, Switzerland, Austria, the Netherlands, and the Czech Republic rallied near the Philippsburg nuclear power plant, 45 minutes from the French border, which the German government had forced to close prematurely. "Public opinion towards nuclear energy is changing," said Bjorn Peters, a German pro-nuclear leader, in late 2019. "Saving nuclear has been two steps forward and one step back. California and New York are moving forward with plans to prematurely close Diablo Canyon and Indian Point nuclear plants, which provide reliable and low-cost carbon-free power to roughly 6 million people, thanks to the influence of groups like NRDC, EDF, Sierra Club, and 350.org. At the same time, a growing number of people appear to recognize the foolishness of doing so and are changing their minds about the technology. In researching and writing this book, I was pleased to find support for nuclear energy from unexpected quarters, including from people with whom I disagreed, at least on some questions. Christine Figener, the German sea turtle scientist, who started a worldwide discussion on straws and plastics, told me she supports nuclear. "I think the world is not black and white," she said. And Zion Lights of Extinction Rebellion told me she had changed her mind after a scientist friend told her it was safe. I said, "That's not what I've been told," and he said, "Don't just listen to what people tell you." And so I looked it up, and he was right. "The data shows it is safe, and I realized solar panels and batteries are not going to meet demand." Some appear to be moderating their views of climate change as well. In December 2019, David Wallace Wells, the author of the apocalyptic 2019 book, The Uninhabitable Earth, which claimed climate change was much, much worse than you think, wrote that, for once, the climate news might be better than you thought. "It's certainly better than I've thought." Wallace Wells pointed to research by Pilkey and others showing that the IPCC's high coal use scenario, known by its technical name RCP 8.5, was highly improbable, and temperatures were likely to peak at below 3 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. In December 2019, I received an email from the IPCC inviting me to be an expert reviewer of its next assessment report. It wasn't the first time IPCC had reached out to me. After I criticized the IPCC in 2018 for its biased treatment of nuclear and renewables, a lead author of an IPCC report encouraged me to become a reviewer. I hadn't followed up on that invitation, but this time, I did. I also received an invitation to testify before Congress on the state of climate science, which I did in January 2020. For more than 20 years, I noted, the national conversation about climate change had been polarized between those who deny it and those who exaggerate it. Happily, it appeared that some scientists, journalists, and activists were finally pushing back against the extremes on both sides. None of the members of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology denied climate change. Most said they thought something should be done to address it. Environmental humanism will eventually triumph over apocalyptic environmentalism, I believe, because the vast majority of people in the world want both prosperity and nature, not nature without prosperity. They are just confused about how to achieve both. For while some environmentalists claimed their agenda will also deliver a greener prosperity, the evidence shows that an organic, low-energy, and renewable-powered world would be worse, not better, for most people and for the natural environment. While environmental alarmism may be a permanent feature of public life, it need not be so loud. The global system is changing. While that brings new risks, it also brings new opportunities. Confronting new challenges requires the opposite of panic. With care, persistence, and, I dare say, love, I believe we can moderate the extremes and deepen understanding and respect in the process. In so trying, I believe we will bring ourselves closer to the transcendent moral purpose most people, perhaps even some currently apocalyptic environmentalists, share: nature and prosperity for all. This is Stephen Graybill. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Apocalypse Never: Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All, by Michael Schellenberger, presented by HarperCollins and Harper Audio. This program was produced by Dion Audio Services. Executive producer, Suzanne Franco Mitchell. Text copyright 2020 by Michael Schellenberger. Production copyright 2020 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.